This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
This song says, no matter who you are, no matter where you go in your life, at some point you're going to need somebody to stand by you.
I'm John Swain. I'm the CEO for the International Civil Rights Center and Museum.
John, you grew up in Roanoke, Virginia?
Actually, on the outskirts of Roanoke, Virginia, near Smith Mountain Lake in Burnt Chimney.
I was up there right after the shooting.
Yes. I also drove up to Virginia to see what was going on in Charlottesville, the killing of Heather Heyer. It kind of shook me a bit to see that happening in my own state, because Virginia is a wonderful place to live. But to see the uprising and the violence, it kind of shook me a bit, because I have better memories of the state than that.
So talk to us a little bit about your experience growing up.
As a young kid coming through school, my classrooms, often one, maybe two black students in a classroom setting, and not focused on where is everybody else, that question never came into my mind until the seventh grade, when I saw a large number of other African-American students, and then on into the high school. So growing up, you're surrounded by people mostly who sheltered you, black and white.
Really a bubble in some way.
To some degree, I would describe it as that. But the way you look at people is very different. You see students, your neighbors, your friends, people who live in your neighborhood, as just folks who are living like you are. They're human beings. You move on with life.
So you really weren't viewing life from a black-white lens. It was just friends and people, and that wasn't even an operative.
It absolutely wasn't a consideration. You just live. You struggle like everybody. You live like everybody. I saw poor white people, poor black people. I saw wealthy white people, wealthier black folks. And you knew that the things that you wanted in life, you just had to learn, grow, develop, and move on with it. Coming to North Carolina.
What brought you down to North Carolina?
I came to North Carolina to be the Director of Finance and Administration for the International Civil Rights Center. I saw the position and I wanted it. That was in 2009. By 2014, the Board of Directors asked me to lead the organization as a CEO. I had a strong finance background, management background, not so much in the museum world, but it's been a steep learning curve and fast. I have found this place to be one of the most exciting places that I've ever worked. You don't tend to get bored. People you meet every day from all over the world. That's what makes it very interesting and unique.
Speaking of unique, there is a uniqueness in the civil rights world right here in Greensboro that's distinctly different in some respects than anywhere else in America.
That is correct.
For example, Memphis, where we've both been, to the National Civil Rights Museum.
Yes.
As we were talking about earlier, that's to really put a spotlight on America's struggles, where you guys are distinctive in that you're the international. Tell us about the why of that.
The primary basis behind our international aspirations, our technical name is Sit In Movement. That's our trade name as a nonprofit organization. But the International Civil Rights Center and Museum is our doing business as name. And the board of directors and the founders chose that because of all of the movements around the world. Internationally, people often look to Greensboro and use Greensboro as a model to bring about social change. And so knowing that, that was the primary basis behind the name of the organization.
It's interesting because we are a half a block from the old Woolworths.
Yeah.
That was the site of the game changer of Greensboro and the world.
Absolutely.
So loop in that connection, because that's pretty seminal.
Four college freshmen, all Negroes, were refused service at a Greensboro, North Carolina lunch counter, and the civil rights sit-in was born.
In this building, was the kickoff of the modern-day civil rights movement, of the sit-in movement.
Across America.
Yes, it was.
This predates the Freedom Bus Riders.
61 was the Freedom Summer and the Freedom Riders. So here in 1960 was the place where the students from North Carolina A&T came and asserted.
A&T, it was the agricultural
and
school.
Technical, yes. Students from Bennett, students from Women's College, now UNCG.
Again, these were not necessarily segregated schools, right?
That is correct. So they came here and asserted their 14th Amendment rights of citizenship, to have a seat at the table. It wasn't about the cup of coffee. It was to assert their rights that were written into law in 1868. Full and equal protection under the law. And so many people have thought that, oh, this was the first sit-in movement. No, it wasn't. There were many movements that kicked off, or sit-in movements that started before this one. This one was more successful because it galvanized national attention. In other places, people lost their lives. These movements were very dangerous, but the students from A&T that started this and went home after graduation, the movement was continued on by the students at James B. Dudley High School. And it continued every single day until July 25th of 1960.
Deconstruct a little bit more about Woolworths.
Yes.
Woolworths were across America and across the South. Some people assume that there was this viral racism within the corporate structure mm-hmm. of Woolworths, and yet my research says no, they mm-hmm. were no mm-hmm. different than any other typical American business.
Correct.
It was just endemic racism.
Woolworths did not have a discriminatory policy per se, but the North Carolina law was Black people and white people would experience segregated dining facilities.
Yeah, you had African Americans who were behind the counter, who worked there.
They worked
right?
for the corporations.
And Black people in town in Greensboro were welcome to shop there.
That is right. Correct. In many of the department stores, Blacks had to shop on the lower levels, like the Cress's department stores, the Lazarus.
Not the case at Woolworths.
At Woolworths, Black customers and white customers came in to this five and dime, and they could buy whatever they wanted to buy. But the only issue was Blacks were not allowed to sit at the F.W. Woolworths lunch counter in that building. That was not Woolworths' policy. That was
that local management?
That was the local law. That was the state
local,
law.
Wow.
That was state law at the time. And so I've seen documents where Woolworths assert in their newsletter that it was not their policy. This store was their flagship store. And so it's quite striking that this Art Deco beautiful building in downtown Greensboro would be the site of a national movement. It is currently under consideration for a World Heritage inscription. We've been working on that process for a while, and I hope that we're able to bring that home. We're quite fortunate that the founders preserved the property from being destroyed and turned into a parking lot.
It's interesting. You had four local college kids mm-hmm. that came together and almost on a whim decided to choose Woolworths in Greensboro to make a statement. And yet that legacy hugely lives on today.
It does.
And tell us about how it resonates around the world.
Today, the Woolworths building is a museum. It houses the International Civil Rights Center and Museum. We took a snapshot in time of the civil rights struggle. It's not a comprehensive story telling every little thing that took place in Greensboro and in other places. There is a finite amount of space. So our architects and designers chose a snapshot and said, this is a story that we need to tell about the complex world that we live in. Here is the violence that has taken place. Here are the movements and the moments that shaped the minds of these young college students. They knew that things weren't right in their world after seeing so much strife and struggle, but they wanted to change that. That brings us up to the lunch counter and to the time period that those students came for, almost 7 months.
One of the touching aspects of experiencing the museum is you have intact in place the whole entire lunch counter.
Yes. We have 53 seats at our lunch counter. When we acquired the property in 1992, two 8-foot sections of the longest portion of the lunch counter were donated to Smithsonian, Museum of American History, with 4 lunch counter seats. We've also donated an 8-foot section and 4 lunch counter seats to the Greensboro History Museum. And we've removed 2 lunch counter seats and donated it to the new African American Museum. I'm sure that other people want portions of it, but we're done with our donating at this point. But the counter has been restored to the way it was.
And everything. I mean, the behind the counter. And
the prices.
Yeah, everything.
The equipment, everything is
it's
there.
Almost like they just closed an hour ago.
Yes, it looks just like that. It is one of our most prized artifacts, and we work very hard to take care of it and keep it in pristine condition for all the world to see.
Tell us a little bit more about experiencing the International Civil Rights Museum and what are some of the memorable takeaways on the tour.
Some of the most memorable moments is when grandparents and grandchildren experience this museum together. It's a wide array of time, and just watching a grandparent walk through a moment in time that they participated in and talk to their grandchildren about what life was like. What side of this history were they standing on? Why? Lots of questions come up. And it's more interesting to go to TripAdvisor and read about the comments after our visitors leave. They come from all over the globe. Many people tell us that they hopped on a plane in San Francisco and flew to Greensboro just to experience this. So we don't want to let them down. But the memorable moments is just going back and reading the comments, the very thoughtful comments that people leave behind, and it tends to push us. But educating students in the 4th, the 5th, the 8th, and 11th grades, our core curriculum and this museum helps these students develop and become more educated about social movements and the way we live together. How we live together. It's interesting to watch students walk into the doors for the first time, and an hour and 15 minutes or an hour and a half later, they come back to the lobby. They are very, very, very different people at that time.
And there's another live game shift that takes place. For example, as a little kid, my dad was stationed in Washington, D.C., 1957. I remember, I was like second grade, but I remember watching the TV of the Little Rock Nine with the National Guard guarding them so they can't get in. You know, didn't understand it, but I remember it vividly. I remember the riots where the fire department was fire hosing people on national news. So, like me, you've had other people come into the International Civil Rights Museum who lived through that in a really chilling way. Tell us about, like, the woman that was connected familial with the Ku Klux Klan.
Yes.
And, yeah, a couple of those stories that are really profound, that they have come back and talked to you.
That's why I say this work, this position, this corporation has been a gift to me. It's changed who I am and what I thought about race relations in the country. For older people, they have an opportunity to come back and heal. For younger people, they come in and they look at this. And they look in disbelief at who we were as a people. And many of our visitors want to educate their kids about what they are seeing in our world is just not normal. It's just not normal. It's who we were. It's not who we have to be. I've talked to people who have had those KKK connections in their own families. They're not.
You have a Klan robe.
A Klan robe
that
yes.
was given to you. Tell us about that story.
Yes, a family donated a robe. After the passing of the grandfather, did not know that he was a member of the Klan, but that robe has a blood stain on it as well. And that's one opportunity for us to connect with kids. We've had young kids to come into the museum and say, oh, my granddaddy has one of those. The child may not fully understand what they're disclosing by saying something like that. But we are a teaching institute. We are an extension to the classroom. And many of the teachers that bring their classes of students to this museum, they will tell us firsthand that they do not fully understand how to teach the civil rights movement. And they are so appreciative that we have this asset here in the state, here in this community, that they can get to so easily. We've had busloads of kids to come across state lines just to experience this place. So I do not take it lightly, the work that we must do every single day to continue to educate the world about the heinous past.
And some of the heinous present.
And the heinous present. We try to stay away from the political issues because the children that visit this museum, they are from Democratic families, independent families, Republican families, reactionaries, families, the whole gamut. So we stay to the facts of this is what occurred during this snapshot. Often folks ask about Malcolm X. They ask about the Greensboro Massacre of 1979, which is going to be experiencing its 40th anniversary. And there's only so much space, but as we grow as an institution, there are times that we can introduce more.
Is there hope to increase your physical footprint?
Yes, we've had that underway for the last 3 or 4 years to grow the institution. We have to protect the boundaries around the institution. It is very important to the world. We were added to Civil Rights Trail in January of 2018. We were one of 10 that were added to that newly inaugurated trail. And so we definitely want to continue to attract people to Greensboro to learn about the movement and to grow the institution.
We're approaching the 60th anniversary of the sit-ins at Woolworths here in Greensboro. So today it's palpable how evolved and different Greensboro is as a community. I mean, it's touching what I have experienced here. Talk to us about Greensboro today and then segue to Greensboro and how its legacy lives on around the world.
Greensboro had a high concentration of Quakers that lived here.
And they still do.
And they still do. And I'd have to say, during the times of the struggle, this movement is one of America's best stories of how a people can have an issue, come together, and solve the problems. They solve the problem. And July 25th of 1960 was the resolution of this issue. Greensboro has had other issues to flare up, but no matter what city you go to, there are always bad actors that live in every city. The issue is, how are we going to identify it and address it so that we can move together as a people? Greensboro is a proud place. It should be proud of its leadership and the efforts that were put forward to bring about powerful changes here. When the rest of the world looks to you and the example of you as a way for they to move forward, I'd say that's quite remarkable. Many people that live here still do not understand what happened here. They do not fully grasp how the rest of the world looks back at Greensboro and say, wow, they got it right. But for those people, there is plenty of opportunity for them to come in and learn. We're going to be here for a long time. This is our 10th year of business, 60 years of activism right here in this neighborhood on a number of different fronts. So there is lots to teach still.
And again, you were talking earlier about how that name, Greensboro, is seared into the world psyche.
You can't change that. Once the skunk is out of the bag, you're not going to put it back. But in this particular sense, I'm coming here as an outsider from Virginia. I am proud of the legacy of Greensboro, of North Carolina. North Carolina has had a tough history of up and down and trying to get citizenship right. What it means to be a citizen of a democracy. But that's why you have many people who are quite educated on these matters to help drive it home and help to get it right.
And it's interesting, the history was never as simple as it seems. I've done a lot of studying the Civil War era here in this region. Mm-hmm. I've interviewed the 58th Regiment from Asheville, North Carolina, mm-hmm. the reenactors, Southern group. And they said, in Ashe today, you do not bring up the Civil War, or as some people say, the War of Northern Aggression, in conversation. Because mm-hmm. as many people in that community, neighbors, would have been Northerners.
Yes.
And the neighbor would have been the Southern allied. So it wasn't yes. this pure, you know, South, simple thing.
There is, in many conversations, there is a way to bring them up and discuss it and know when to just put it back down, because it's not going to go anywhere. It's not going to make a better tomorrow for any of us. But they're very passionate people who live here. Very passionate. I try to be very careful because I'm, like I said, a short period of time with the area. And a lot of my focus has been on maintaining this one little place down here. So I feel like I'm doing my part as an outsider, but professionally, I'm proud of the work that we've been able to do here in Greensboro and will continue to do for years to come. Greensboro is it's a great place. People here should be proud.
I agree. If somebody wanted to learn more about the International Civil Rights Museum, where would you direct them?
I would direct them to our website at sitinmovement, S-I-T-I-N, movement. sitinmovement.org. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, sitinmuseum.com.org. Also, go to TripAdvisor and read about experiences. Come to Greensboro and visit the rich history here. My name is John Swain. I'm the CEO for the International Civil Rights Center and Museum.
Thanks, John.
Thank you for this opportunity.
You're welcome. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Greensboro, North Carolina. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
Associate producers include Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Molly Blaisdell, San Francisco, and Katya Singel, San Luis Obispo, California.
Underwriting support for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided in part by the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. People often associate the Society of St. Vincent de Paul with thrift stores. Donations like clothing, your gently used couch, or still serviceable washing machine generate funds to assist the Society in putting food on the table for people in need, or keeping the lights on and families in their homes. To find a St. Vincent de Paul thrift store in your area, visit svdpusa.org. Once again, svdpusa.org. And whether you're shopping for new or used items, donating them, or volunteering, you're helping the Society of St. Vincent de Paul help others.
Enough to die.